As a reminder, continue to pray for Miss Nellie in the hospital and for Sharon and Alan as they're trying to find a place for her. They told them, you need to try to find a place for her by Monday. And, of course, it's the weekend. And how in the world do you, even the people you need to talk to aren't available on the weekend to get that done. So pray for open doors, for direction, for patience as they try to get this done, and for some relief from the pain that Miss Nellie's experiencing. She's got this really intense pain in her back, taking the pain meds. It's helping a little, but it's going to be a while before she's going to be past that. And so she's pretty miserable. So continue to pray for her. And also, since she's laid up, we didn't call her and ask, where do you want the ladies to meet for lunch on Thursday? And Fats closed. So Janet worked on this and contacted me this afternoon and said that the ladies are going to meet at the Chicken Salad Chick over on Alps Road at 11:30 on Thursday. So she'll be contacting those who might not be here, but I'll let you know, ladies, it's a place called the Chicken Salad Chick over on Alps Road for lunch at 11:30 on Thursday. All right? Did you get a copy of the outline? If you didn't, wave your hand. We can see if we can get one of those to you. Anybody need one of those? Brother Spital has those. We're here too. We're in Esther chapter 4 this evening. The opening section of the book of Esther, we focused on the theme of the threat to Israel. Here we begin with the deliverance of Israel in this section, particularly, first of all, with the plan of Mordecai. The first three chapters climaxed in the section we looked at last time. The plot against Israel was revealed to be the handiwork of Haman, who was descended from the ancient enemy of Israel, Agag, the Amalekite. But now Haman is the trusted advisor of the king of Persia, Darius of Persia. Well, he felt insulted because Mordecai didn't bow down when he walked by. And so when he found out Mordecai wasn't bowing, that nasty Jew, he decided to retaliate, not by eliminating Mordecai, but he decided he's going to eliminate everybody that's a Jew. All the Jews. An empire-wide genocide of everybody who is ethnically Jewish. And he's going to wipe out the Jewish population throughout the Persian Empire, which is pretty much everywhere, because Persia claimed pretty much everything. There were a few places to the far east of them, territory we'd know as India and China, but places in Europe they didn't control, but there really weren't very many Jews in those places either. If they wipe out the Jews in the Persian Empire, that's going to take care of pretty much all of them, including Palestine, which is one of their territories too. Well, he cast lots, as we saw last time. He cast lots to determine the most auspicious day on which to have this pogrom for the removal of the Jews, and he settled on the 13th day of the 12th month. God in his providence put it late in the year. Haman assumed that meant he had plenty of time to get organized and get all of the law written and it communicated throughout the empire, so that he was not necessarily thinking about the possibility that also gave God time to act, to get a counteroffensive in place, which he's already been working on for a lot longer than Haman's been mad at Mordecai. God's been moving the players into position here. Once Haman got his date chosen, he had to sell it to the king, and so he told Darius that there was a people scattered throughout the empire. They were disrupting the peace because they're following their own laws. They're not following your own rule. They're threatening your own rule, in fact, they said. And he promised to pay into the king's treasury a massive sum of about 375 tons of silver. So it's going to be to the king's great advantage, according to Haman, if you eliminate these people. And so the king approved, and he gave Haman permission to write up an edict, sign it in the king's name, gave him the king's signet ring. And Haman wrote that order up so that everyone in the kingdom would be ordered to rise up against all the Jews that they knew, and annihilate them on a particular day, and to confiscate their property, whether it was to keep it or to turn it over to the treasury of the palace is not clear. And so he's got all this in place, but God has been orchestrating his own counteroffensive for years. And so as we come to chapter 4, we're at the turning point in the narrative. Here, the defensive pieces that God has on the table begin to be revealed and brought into play. It's going to take some time to develop, and the whole situation is not resolved in tonight's chapter. But it's beginning, and it's beginning quietly. Well, God could have resolved all of this with a bolt of lightning from heaven, like in the sort of thing that consumed the altar when Elijah was up against the prophets of Baal. He could have resolved this with an earthquake. He could have resolved this with handwriting on the wall. He had done that fairly recently in Babylon. This time, God chooses to eschew the spectacle and to do something that's more consistent with the way he usually works. Quietly, in the background, he's working through the rather ordinary actions behind the scenes of frightened people who were not sure of their role and who were uncertain of the outcome. Does that sound just a little familiar? Is not that much the way most of life tends to work? And God is directing in circumstances with which I think we can relate. Although there's a lot more at stake for these people, the players that are involved don't know what's happening, don't know what to do about it, and they're scared. And they've got to trust God to direct and to use them as he sees fit. And we see that. God's never mentioned explicitly, but his providential direction of all of these events becomes quite obvious as it goes. Now, we're going to read this in small segments as we go, but before we begin, before we go any further, let's ask the Lord to bless our study this evening. Lord, we pray that as we come to you tonight and look at this particular passage from your word, that we might understand the history, understand what's going on here, and some of the tensions that the people would be feeling. But also, Lord, help us to learn the lessons that you have for us through this, because this is given to us as an example, so we'd understand how you work, so that we would be more prone to trust in circumstances we don't understand. And when things look very, very bleak, that we might have confidence that your plan is still underway, and it is not threatened because you are still on your throne and in control. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, I call the first three verses of chapter 4 Mordecai's anguish. Mordecai's anguish, these first three verses, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Now it says at the beginning of this chapter, Mordecai learned all that had been done. He learned all that had been done. I don't want us to overlook the word all there either. I think it's more than just the text of the decree. The text of the decree is being spread throughout the kingdom, but this implies that he knows something about the events that had resulted in the decrees being issued. Somebody had to write this record, and who got where this information came from, we're not told for sure. But somehow Mordecai got this information, and we don't know how he came by this information. Maybe he was so well regarded by the palace staff that somebody reported it to him. It's also simply possible that the palace rumor mill was particularly well informed, as they had somebody who was serving the king and Haman overheard the conversation and started spreading the word. That's also possible. I think part of it is that neither Haman nor the king thought secrecy was particularly advantageous. There's no need to keep this a secret. They can do what they want. And they've decided there's a people that's out there that's going to hurt the kingdom, and the king has given Haman approval, and so the Haman's talking it up. I think Haman's probably boasting about what he's done and what he's managed to accomplish here. He was proud of it, and he wasn't trying to hide it. Somehow, word of all of this plotting and what Haman has in mind, and how, because Mordecai talks about the people being sold, there's information about the purchase price that he's going to be paying to the king that has to be a part of what Mordecai learned. And when he learned this, he began what I've simply called here uninhibited mourning. Uninhibited mourning. The Jewish display of grief and sadness and sorrow is pretty traditional. Tearing one's clothes indicated profound dismay, profound grief. Sackcloth was a very coarsely woven fabric, kind of like burlap, but made out of goat hair. It was scratchy. It was very uncomfortable, and it would be worn right next to the skin just to keep one's skin irritated, so you can't rest or be comfortable. To indicate great distress, rubbing ashes on your head or throwing them on your body and rubbing them into your face was to indicate humiliation and sorrow. And this was a fairly typical way for the Jews to display great distress. All of these were visible, even very obvious, outward signs of mourning. And then once he's done this, he's put on his sackcloth and maybe put on his outer garments over them in tatters because he's torn them. He's covered in ashes. He goes out into the city streets wailing loudly and bitterly. The Hebrew word meaning cry, which is not quiet tears but loud wailing, actually shows up twice in this verse. The King James, the New King James, and ESV are three of the versions that actually translate it twice accurately. But he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. So it shows up twice there to emphasize the audible nature of his mourning here. He walked through the city toward the palace. But it tells us he didn't enter the palace gate. Now, his normal post was at the palace gate, but he didn't go through it. And the author of Esther reports no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Now, there are Persian records that indicate that was, in fact, the law. There are no Persian records that explain why. So we can only guess as to why that might have been law. It's possible, and commentators are always willing to guess. It's possible that someone who was in mourning was considered unclean by the king. It's possible that the king simply didn't want to be depressed by people who were in distress. It's also possible the king just thought wearing sackcloth was undignified, and he didn't want anybody coming in through his gate in such an undignified manner. We don't have a clue. Tell you the truth. All those things have been suggested by commentators and historians, but nobody knows for sure why. It's just the rule. The king said nobody can come through the king's gate dressed in sackcloth. I think it's interesting that Mordecai honored that rule. He did not defy the rule. He stopped at the gate. He did not go through the gate. Those who say that his refusal to bow down before Haman was was Mordecai being provocative and disobedient, I think missed the point. Mordecai refused to bow before Haman because he was not going to worship a man, particularly a man who was an enemy of the Jews. He wasn't going not just pay him that kind of respect, but those were words particularly of worship, and he just refused because he was a Jew. But he's going to respect the king's right to set boundaries, and he's not going to go through and violate the king's order not to enter through the gate. So it tells us a little more. Mordecai was not a provocateur. He was not a guy who was exercising civil disobedience. He's a guy trying to honor the king and the king's rules as best he can, as long as it doesn't interfere and conflict with his own religious convictions. It's just that the writer of this record is avoiding the use of God's name and making God's presence really obvious in all of this. Well, he didn't go through this, and as we'll see when we get to verse 6, he took a very visible position in the open area of the marketplace just outside or in front of the gate. I think it's important to note, too, that Mordecai is not expressing regret over having refused to bow before Haman. Mordecai is not saying, "Oh, what have I done in having provoked this evil man? Lord, forgive me for having made him so angry that he's going to do this to your children." There's not a hint of repentance in anything Mordecai says or does. He's not backing away. Somebody's stereo out there is causing the windows to rumble, all right? He's not backing away from that. He's done what it was the right thing to do. He's not offering any kind of apology or any kind of repentance. He's grieving over the pending destruction of the Jews because of the evil of Haman. Haman is the one in the wrong, not Mordecai. We're also told the Jews everywhere reacted exactly the same way Mordecai had. Jews throughout the kingdom, all over the place, all the Jews were reacting in much the same way. There's no indication they were following his example. It's not as if somebody posted a meme of Mordecai in mourning on Twitter and everybody saw it and starts looking, says, oh, that's a good idea, I'm going to do that too. This is just the way people all over the kingdom were responding when they get the word. Because the Jews were recognizing the great threat to their very existence. In verses 4 to 8, we have Mordecai's appeal. This section actually starts with Esther's reaction to the news of Mordecai's mourning at the beginning of verse 4. Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in anguish, in great anguish. I think it's interesting. Esther's staff informed her of Mordecai's mourning. And the text doesn't say staff, but she's been queen for a while now. She has her own maidens and eunuchs that attend to her. And it strikes me as maybe a little bit surprising. Why would they tell her about Mordecai? We've been told she has not yet made public her identity as a Jewess. I mean, it would make sense, and you'd kind of expect that maybe she would overhear some talk about that crazy Jew out in the courtyard who's screaming and carrying on, wearing sackcloth and covered up in ashes. You know, that rascal Mordecai the Jew that Haman's so angry with. But that's not what happened. They came and reported to her. I think what we need to understand is, you know, Esther has been queen for 5 years now. And I suspect that in those 5 years, she has managed to either surround herself with a staff that is predominantly Jewish, or she has managed to convert them. So they are sympathetic. We're going to see in a few verses that when she decides she's going to fast, she gets them to fast with her. And there's absolutely no point in getting them to fast with her if they weren't also believers. There's no Jewess in the world that would have asked an unbeliever to fast with her for something, right? I think it says something about her character that her staff, when they heard about Mordecai out there and what's going on, see, she's been shut up in the harem for a while. She doesn't get out much. And so she's insulated from the outside world and the outside news. And so somebody had to bring her word that her cousin, Mordecai, they had to know who she was. Or there had been zero reason for them to have brought her this report. They knew who she was, and they were sympathetic with the situation. And here's a situation. Now, here we find in this verse that there's a place, one of the rare places, where the King James provides what you'd call a dynamic equivalent translation, and the New American Standard gives the literal. Normally, the accusation is the opposite, that newer translations give a dynamic equivalent. Because what the text actually says, the King James says that she was in great distress, or she was exceedingly grieved, excuse me. The queen was exceedingly grieved. Well, that's absolutely true, and that's what this indicates. Grieved is not the word that's used there. It's writhed in agony. Is what the phrase says. She writhed in agony, and it was a great agony. And so writhed in great anguish, as the New American Standard translates literally. That's how deep was her distress when she heard of Mordecai's mourning. She doesn't yet know why he's mourning. She just knows he is. And so it troubles her greatly, so that she writhed in great anguish at the word that Mordecai was in such mourning, the queen, it says there in the middle of verse 4. And so we're told she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. She sent him clothing, maybe to end his mourning, maybe to give him the garments he'd need to be able to come into the palace so she could talk to him. Because he can't come in sackcloth. Whatever her intent may have been, he refused to change his clothes. He refused to put on the garments that she sent to change out of his sackcloth, so it remained impossible for him to come to her. There was no way she could get to him or he could get to her while he's out there mourning. And so it may be because she still needs to keep her Jewish identity secret from the king and from Haman, she doesn't go to him herself. It's also possible her movements are a little restricted there being in the palace harem. But she sent Hatak, I guess is the best way to say that. She sent Hatak to ask Mordecai why he was so distressed in verses 5 and 6. Esther summoned Hatak from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So, it says, Hatak went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. And now again, I think this supports what I was saying earlier about her hand-selected staff. Hatak is identified differently. He is not someone she selected. He's a man the king appointed from among his own eunuchs, the eunuchs on his staff. He appointed this man to be her personal liaison to the king, if you will. He's also apparently sort of a supervisor and a supervisory attendant for her. And he was the king's choice, not one of hers. But evidently she trusted him. Trusted him enough with the information of who she was that she was willing to send him to Mordecai to find out why he's so distressed and come back and report to her. All this palace stuff just interests me and what they must have been thinking. I mean, everybody knows that's Mordecai the Jew. That's how he's identified. That's how he's been identified through here. And I think it says something really important about Esther's character. That her staff and even the appointed watch guard over her that the king appointed are so loyal to her personally. That when he goes and talks to Mordecai and he reports back to her, not to anybody else. Because if he took this word to Haman, she could be in some pretty serious trouble. Or even potentially to the king, because she has no idea how the king's feeling about any of this, because she doesn't even know what's going on yet. But if Hatak reported this to the wrong people, this could be problematic. But it says something about her character, that these people are also loyal to her personally. Well, Hatak did as the queen instructed. He went out to see Mordecai in the street or in the city square, that wide open area as a marketplace in front of the palace entrance. And Mordecai told him everything, verses 7 and 8. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. That wasn't in the edict. Okay, that information wasn't in the edict, but Mordecai had that information. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her. So first he told him all that had happened to him. And all that had happened to him has to include Haman's determination to destroy Mordecai. There's this conflict I have with Haman, because he refused to bow to him. He also reports Haman's promise of payment to the king. In fact, the exact amount for which he had sold the Jews to destruction. Which makes the king complicit even if the king's not fully informed. Even if the king doesn't even understand all this, if he's not thought through the ramifications of it, and doesn't know who all the people are that are going to be involved. But you understand that this fact adds a profound level of risk to anybody who's going to get involved in this. To anybody who might try to derail what Haman's doing, there's a huge risk because it's going to cost the king a fortune if Haman isn't successful now. And he gave him then a copy of the edict that Haman had written, which may not yet have been known to the king's own harem and their attendants, or even to his palace staff, as far as the text of this order that had been sent out. But Esther needs to realize just how dire this situation is, and that Mordecai's grief wasn't an exaggeration. He's not overplaying this. This is something just changing my clothes to come to see you isn't sufficient. He wants her to understand that. And so in the last part of verse 8, Mordecai has given him the edict issued in Susa for their destruction that he might show, that he, that is Hatak, might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king, to implore his favor, and to plead with him for her people. Mordecai told Hathach to order Esther to go to the king and plead with him for her people. Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure Esther's identity as a Jewish wasn't new information to Hathach, but if it had been, that cat is well and truly out of the bag now, because he just said, plead for her people. And I'm a little surprised at the forcefulness of Mordecai's insistence here. Makes me wonder a little bit about who Hathach might have been if Mordecai thought Hathach had the authority to order the queen to do anything. Right? And Mordecai, who may he have been if he thought he had the authority to order Hathach to do something? Right? A little higher ranking than maybe we've given him credit for being. But he told her, you need to order her to go in and confront the king. And so we see Esther's answer in verses 9 to 17. First, demonstrating that her trust had not been misplaced, Hathach reported Mordecai's words to Esther in verse 9. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther, not anybody else. But she turns the table a bit, and instead of then following the orders of Mordecai to go to the king, she orders Hathach to do something. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death. Unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. So these words, now, this her reply has three parts. First of all, there's a citation of the law. Then there's the a possible exception, although a rare exception to the law, and what her current situation was. First of all, she says to Mordecai, tell Mordecai this, make sure you underscore this. Everybody knows this. All the king's servants, those who are critical to this immediate situation, all the people of the king's provinces, that's the rest of the people in the realm. In short, she's saying, Mordecai, you know this, that everybody knows this. The penalty for entering the king's court without being summoned was death. Going in there without invitation, without being ordered to, is suicide. That goes for anyone, man or woman. There's no way anybody living in Susa didn't know that, particularly in the palace. Now, the king could extend mercy, but that's rare. That's the second part of a reply. The king, and you know this too. Essentially, here's the situation. The king's in his palace. He's doing whatever he does. And somebody walks in uninvited. The king doesn't have to even acknowledge them. Security will take care of it. Drag him out, execute him. Or her. The only exception to that is if the king notices the person and welcomes them by extending his scepter to them. It's the only way. The king doesn't have to give an order. The order is already standing. Now, whether or not the king's going to respond that way to her when she walks in is going to depend entirely on one of three things. It's going to be whatever kind of mood he's in, whatever business she has interrupted, and whatever the king happens to be thinking about that person at the time, whatever his attitude toward that person might be. And she hadn't been summoned before the king in 30 days, and she's the queen. The point of that is that there's an implication that she's not real sure what her status in the king's eyes may be right now. And we all remember what happened the last time a queen who defied his orders by refusing to come when ordered. And she was a favorite. What happens now if I walk in and he hadn't even cared to even see me for the last month? Well, Esther's message was delivered to Mordecai, and Mordecai sent an urgent reply in verses 13 and 14. Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Now, his statement is loaded with implications here. This, the urgency. First, he needs her to understand that she would not be exempt from this genocide. When the edict is enacted and when that date arrives and all the Jews in the kingdom are to be executed, you don't get special treatment. It may not be well known that you're a Jewess, but there are people who know, including Hatak, who's acting as our messenger right now. And he works for the king. Your position as queen will not protect you. The law, as written, does not allow exceptions. Now, I don't think Mordecai was particularly concerned about what's actually going to happen to the Jews. Did you notice that? He does not say, if you don't act, all the Jews will be annihilated. There's an important evidence of genuine faith because he anticipates that if you don't do something, God, he doesn't use God's name, but relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. The word translated relief means breath or breathing freely. He was confident that the Jews will be able once again to breathe freely by the action of some other agent. If not you, somebody. But, he adds, you and your father's house will perish. Now, who is her father's house? Who does he mean by that? I mean, does she have other relatives? If so, why weren't they responsible for her instead of Mordecai? Mordecai, I don't think you would list as being part of her father's house. He's a cousin, descended from an uncle, not part of her father's house. Who would then be in her father's house if she had been left alone and in Mordecai's care? She's been queen for 5 years. You suspect possibly she has a child? Maybe more than one? We don't know. There's nothing to say one way or another. But I suspect that he's alluding to possible future generations that might come from her. We're also at risk, not just you. And you and your children will be subject to execution. So remaining silent would doom her family, not doom the Jews. Mordecai is confident, without saying God's name, that God will not let the Jews die. Not completely. But if you don't help, you will. And so then Mordecai asks the question that really is central to the doctrine of providence as a key to understanding the book of Esther. He states it as a rhetorical question, who knows, but, and I've just rephrased it as a statement, perhaps, for the sake of the outline, perhaps she had become queen for this moment alone. Maybe right now is the one moment in history for which you've become queen. I cannot imagine but what she and Mordecai had lengthy conversations trying to speculate on what purpose God might have had in bringing her to this place. And not really having an answer. But Mordecai says, maybe God engineered such a marvelous change of fortune because of this very purpose. He has utter confidence in the doctrine of God's sovereign providence. The problem is, if God's going to raise up a deliverer from somewhere else, I really don't know where he's going to come from. He does not see a champion on the horizon. Now, neither did Saul when David showed up in the camp to fight Goliath. So there's always the possibility that a champion will come from some unseen place. But Esther, remember, it could be you're there for this purpose. So here's the situation. If you wanted to draw up a risk-reward diagram, there's two alternatives. You can go in before the king, or you can remain silent. If you remain silent, what's going to happen? You're going to die. Pretty much guaranteed, the edict's going to go into effect, and you're going to die. If a deliverer is raised up from somewhere out in the provinces, it's not going to help you in the palace. or you can go in before the king. If you go in before the king, good chance you're going to die. There is a possibility on this side, though, that the king might decide to extend mercy. And if he does, there's a chance for total deliverance. The risk for either action is the same. There's a potential reward for this action. Mordecai figures this makes sense. He's not sure Esther recognizes that. But he's trying to get her to recognize that it's worth the risk at this point because it's the only option with any potential for reward, for deliverance. So Esther sends to Mordecai what I believe is her courageous reply. There are some commentators like Yamauchi who says it appears that initially Esther was more concerned about her own welfare than about her people. I'm not sure that's fair. I think mostly she wanted to make sure Mordecai understood the risk she was going to have to take if she went into appeal to the king. If it was fear causing her to hesitate, she was pretty easily persuaded by Mordecai's appeal to the doctrine of God's sovereignty and God's providence. So she tells Mordecai in verse 15 and 16, Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." She told Mordecai to assemble all the Jews in Susa for a 3-day fast. She says, fast for me. I think she's meaning for her success, not for her survival. The Jewish calendar specified only one day a year that required fasting. That was on the Day of Atonement. And so to call for a 3-day fast was exceptional. It was not part of a typical Jewish activity. Now, this was not a 72-hour fast, probably more like a 48-hour fast. It would begin on that day as the first day. It would end on the third day. It would go through 2 nights and the intervening day. So probably about a 48-hour period that she calls for a fast. However, this is a stricter fast than usual as well, because not only were they going to abstain from eating any food, they were going to abstain from drinking any beverages as well. Neither eat nor drink anything for this period. It doesn't specifically mention prayer, but this is almost the only place in the Old Testament where fasting is not linked with prayer specifically. And I think, again, it's the author's intent to keep God in the background. But a fast was always a voluntary accompaniment to prayer. Otherwise, there's no point in fasting. And she and her maidens, she said, would also fast in the palace. And I think this is another indication that she has built for herself a staff of Jews, maybe Jewish proselytes, because there's no other reason to have them involved in this fast if they don't believe what she believes. And so they're going to join her in this fast and, I believe, prayer. And then she made her pledge, after this fast, she would appeal to the king. And she says, if I perish, I perish. Patton, in his commentary, called this a despairing expression of resignation to the inevitable. And I think that's an awfully dark way to paint that. I don't think that's the best way to understand it. Here I think Yamauchi is, Stevenson. I like Stevenson's comment on this. He says she shows her willingness to accept whatever God had for her in this situation. She shows her willingness to accept whatever God had for her in this situation. I think that's the best way to understand this. Her words echo the words of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you recall, when they were told to bow down before the image and they didn't do it, and so when the king pulled them in, he says, you're going to do it or you're going to get tossed in the fiery furnace. And they said, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Her words echo those words of a generation or two or three before. It's probably worth noting, as a historical footnote, the Greek historian Herodotus comments on the law forbidding intrusion on the king. He indicates that it was, in fact, the real law. He says he provides a list of six officials exempt from it who come in with the king without invitation because the king needed these officials to be able to have access to him. But that implies even further that this law was, in fact, enforced. Herodotus adds a proviso. He explains there was a proviso in the law that would allow a person to send a message to the king and request an audience. In giving that information, Yamauchi says, why this procedure did not occur to Esther can only be surmised, end quote. And I honestly can't imagine that the procedure didn't occur to Esther. I don't think it's that she forgot she could send a message and ask for an audience. I think she chose not to for a couple of reasons. If she sent this request and the king refused her request, or if he simply delayed to answer, now what does she do? If she walks in unannounced, now she's defying the king. She's got a much better chance just walking in with him unsuspecting than if he's had a chance to tell her yes and he's instead told her no or simply ignored her. Now if she comes in, she's intruding in defiance of him, and that's much more risky. Yeah, she might have gotten permission to come in, but I don't think that she was missing an opportunity and it just didn't occur to her. I think she recognized a better chance of survival if she just walks in, and she wasn't willing to wait. She wasn't willing to risk being refused an audience, and so she was just going to go in unannounced. And there's a little bit of irony in the wording of the last verse of the chapter. Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. All these things he's been commanding her. And now she tells him, you organize a fast and I'll go see the king. But he succeeded in encouraging her to take this very dangerous but necessary action. And so he's going to go organize this 3-day fast. So he went to organize a fast in verse 17. Now, that's a terrible place to leave the story, but that's where the author breaks at this chapter. So, 3 or 4 lessons from this chapter and we're done. Again, I want to point out the diabolical nature of anti-Semitism. The devil and his agents have been working to destroy the people of God from the beginning. He's doing his best to make it impossible for the Messiah to come. And if he can annihilate the Jews before Messiah is born, he succeeds. So he's working there now. He's continued to seek the destruction of the Jews, even in recent decades and generations. But we see that that's an attitude that still prospers even today. Another lesson that I think is worth noting here is the importance of a community of faith. Importance of a community of faith. Mordecai's exhortations to Esther to act, I think, give us some idea of how important one believer's counsel and encouragement can be to another in a tough situation. Instead of just leaving them alone on their own, it can be important to help nudge an individual, encourage an individual in making a difficult decision. But then there was also the importance of the corporate prayer and fasting when they were in great distress and in great danger, that Mordecai was rallying others to participate, and Esther was getting her own staff to participate. It's an important support network that God has given us in the church. And we shouldn't cut ourselves off from that. That's one of the vital reasons why an individual ought to belong to a local church. Because there will come times in one's life when you're going to want and need the support and encouragement from other believers that you can really only find from participation in a local church. And we're reminded of that in how we see the support through the fasting and the communication going on. Something else we see is, again, a reminder of the necessity of confidence in God's sovereignty. God's in charge. Mordecai is confident that God's in charge. It may be that God put you there, Esther, so that you can do this. But if you don't, if that's not what he has in mind, and if you die when you go in before the king, God's going to take care of the Jews. That's all implied in what he says. Confidence in God's sovereignty. But there's also, kind of like I mentioned this morning, related to what I mentioned this morning, there's evidence in this chapter that God's purposes are for our service, not our comfort. God didn't make Esther queen so she could be comfortable, so she could have all this rich stuff. He made her queen because she was going to have to do something uncomfortable. And she's going to have to step up and act courageously in this position. Brenneman makes this comment. He says, God had guided in her being chosen queen. In the biblical perspective, election is for service, not just for one's own benefit. Being liberator of her people was more important than being queen of Persia. End quote. You see, we need to remember, we must never forget, God didn't save you and he didn't save me just so we can go to heaven. He saved you and he saved me to bring glory to himself because he has something for us to do that in his service to glorify him. Paul says God drafted you into his army, so you need to be a good soldier. And I got to tell you, being a soldier is not an occupation that is frequently known for creature comforts and safety. But sometimes we chafe when we're not as comfortable as we think we ought to be. Well, Esther found herself in a position where now she's going to have to potentially sacrifice not just her comfort, but her life to do the one thing it may be that God had given her to do. Let's pray. Father, we pray that you would give us the perspective on life that is so trusting in your control.